Well, good morning, everybody. I mean, good afternoon, everybody. I just got a preliminary announcement to make of a debate, Socialist Worker Student Society. Is capitalism collapsing? Speakers, Professor Lord Desai, the Economics Department, Chris Harmon, editor of Socialist Worker. If you want to come Wednesday, November the 4th, 12:30 to 2 in room S78. It's worth coming to hear Megnan talk about the collapse of capitalism. 12:30 to 2 anyway, room S78 if anyone's interested. Before I start today, can I just make a couple of qualifications about these lectures and what the lectures are in fact about. The title, I realise, Politics Over After Socialism, could be misleading. What I'm offering is not an insight into the mind of Tony Blair or a discussion of third way politics. It's not primarily that. So if anyone came for that, that's not really, not primarily anyway, what I'm talking about. The core of the lectures is really about the impact of socialist traditions, where they came from, the role of Marx and Marxism in these traditions, and what their fate is today. I don't think you can really understand contemporary political debates unless you do have a good sense of the impact which socialism and Marxism have made in world history. Really important to remember that when one's studying socialism and Marxism, these are not just academic concerns. They have shaped 19th and 20th century world history. Something happened the last 20 or 30 years which blunted that. In the latter bit of these lectures, last two or three, four lectures, I'll be looking at what the fate of socialism is and why it seems to have collapsed. But before that, I plan to spend a fair amount of time discussing Marx, Marxism, and the contours of socialist thinking. And therefore, it is not an introduction to Tony Blair and New Labour, and I hope it's a bit more far-reaching, really. Its intellectual contours. Secondly, this is basically an introductory course. I mean, I intend it as a fairly serious course of lectures, not just something to do in the lunchtime. But I also intend it to be elementary. That is, it's intended for students who don't have much background in these ideas. It's not really an advanced level course because it's good for me to try and reach as wide an audience as possible. So, I mean, superstars sitting in the audience, I hope that you'll forgive me. A good deal of what I have to say is a straightforward analysis of basic ideas which have shaped the last 150 years in social and political thought. Where I got to last time, if you remember, was the impact of the twin revolutions which have transformed our lives. My main argument last time was one that is still controversial, that is that modernity, the civilization in which we live, is simply not just an extension of other civilizations. It is something new, and in our time it has become genuinely global. Whatever industrialism is, whatever democracy is, they are global in their impact. No other civilization has achieved such an impact. We have to look at what the dynamism of modernity is, how this society is so dynamic. There is something different, really, about our world from the world in which anyone else has lived. And over a period of only something like 200 years, there have been transformations much, much greater, probably, than in the preceding 100,000 years, which is an entirely remarkable thing because it means our lives are kind of experimental. We're living on the edge of history. We're not just living in the flow of history. We're living on the edge of a kind of grand historical experiment whose consequences we don't know, but which is certainly a much more dramatically adventurous society than any previous civilization was. I think it's crucial to understand this, to really grasp the background of the evolution of modern political thinking, as well as social analysis more broadly conceived. Now, out of this flux, you remember you're talking here about the late 18th century primarily. Late 18th century, in a way, is quite like the late 20th century because we're probably also living through a period of revolutionary transformation, about which I'll be talking in subsequent lectures. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, they realized they were living through a period of massive transformation. It's out of this early period of transformation, really, the impact of revolution in history, because remember, I tried to argue last time, revolution is not something you find through all history. Revolution is a feature of recent history. Political thought, as we know it, grew up in reaction to those circumstances. If you take it that there are three main kind of orientations to political theory that are still with us, they all grew up in relation to the twin impact of the Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution, what sense one should make of them. These did not exist before. There were not names for these things before the early 19th century, late 18th century. They didn't exist before these changes brought them into being. They were political reactions to the changes I discussed last time. One is conservatism. Of course, you can say that there have always been people who've clung to tradition and so forth, and therefore, in a sense, a conservative outlook on the world might be long-standing. But the idea of conservatism as a political approach, as a political idea system, was born of the two revolutions. It was, above all, a reaction to the French Revolution, which sought, the French Revolution, I described it last time, sought for the first time to introduce a secular wonderland, a secular heaven on earth, if you like, rather than a religious one. Conservatism was created as a reaction to that, and in the writings of the famous early conservatives, such as Edmund Burke, probably the founder of conservatism, really, the main reaction was, well, you can't torture the world to human design. Conservatives argued you must let the past have a strong influence upon the present. They thought the French revolutionists were trying to twist history, to make history subservient to human design. History cannot be like that. The attitude of the French revolutionaries was exactly that picked up by Marx 40 or so years later. The conservatives rejected it. And they have rejected it, I think, all the way and through until relatively recent times. When we come to look at recent conservatism, we'll see that it's very different from conservatism in its origins. There are some major differences. Conservatism, if you want to put it sort of succinctly, is a defense of tradition. The idea of tradition is central to conservatism because, according to conservatives, the early conservatives writing at the beginning of the 19th century, the birth of conservatism, tradition contains the residue of the past. You shouldn't simply destroy the past in the name of the future. Now, destroying the past in the name of the future is exactly what the second tradition, socialism, sought to do. Socialism is a product of the late 18th century, early 19th century. The word socialism, so far as we know, was invented very late on in the 18th century. It didn't come to be widely used until some way into the 19th century, actually. Socialism, for reasons I'll be describing in this lecture, was a reaction to what seemed to many people to be a rise of individualism. Socialism stressed the social, the communal. That's why socialism has exactly the same root as communism. And I think this is something to be very careful about because, of course, in the 20th century, communism came to mean something very specific. Soviet communism, Chinese communism, and so on. But it didn't mean anything particularly distinguishable from socialism in its origins. Communism also suggests that we are social beings. We depend upon community. Community is the basis of human individuality and human prosperity. That's all communism was really in the beginning, a stress upon the communal, exactly like socialism, a stress upon the social. So For many years, people used socialism and communism as interchangeable words. This was true of Marx, actually. Subsequent Marxists introduced a distinction between them, but Marx by and large used the words interchangeably. They had the same root, they had the same concerns. They're both based upon the idea, well, let's collectively get together and impose our will on history, but we can only do it socially or collectively. We shouldn't do it as selfish individuals. Alongside those, you have liberalism. Liberalism is also a creation of exactly the same period. Liberals, by and large, in the 19th century anyway, believed in the liberty-creating qualities of the market. They saw a market society emerging. By and large, they liked it. This is the difference between these three. The liberals liked the market society they saw being created because they felt it gave a good deal of play to individual freedom and was the condition of prosperity. Conservatives didn't like it. They wanted to return to a previous era. Early conservatism very much stamped by the idea of a return to feudal traditions, that the overthrow of the old regime should not have happened. The old regime was the ancien regime, was the guiding sort of principle of early, or some versions of early conservatism. The socialists didn't like the market either, but the socialists thought rather than going back, we have to go forward. Rather than simply accepting a market society, we should transform society. A market society is based on individualism. We want a society based upon conscious human control. Now, I would stress that each of these terms, after the early 19th century, well, already by the early 19th century, acquired numerous meanings. There is no simple continuity in political theory. Socialism changes across the century. Conservatism and liberalism do too. These terms now mean many different things. Don't look for a simple unity in their history, because there isn't too much of a unity. And of course, there are other political views which grew up alongside them, which I won't discuss directly in these lectures, such as anarchism and fascism, creations of fascism, certainly a later period of history. This is not an exhaustive classification, but it's a crucial classification, because I think, by and large, this threefold division is still, even though the meanings have changed, this is the basic structure of modern politics, really. It's oriented around the debates primarily between these three traditions of thought. So we're looking, at least in these first lectures, at the socialist tradition. And you can't study the socialist tradition without knowing the ideas of Karl Marx, who lived, as I mentioned last time, from 1818 to 1883. Now, history of Marxism is a completely amazing thing, because what you can say is that Marx and Marxism are more generally socialism, because lots of socialists have been anti-Marxists, of course, but Marxism and socialism dominated most of 20th century world history. Certainly from the Russian Revolution through to 1989, this was the century of socialism. And until not very long before 1989, more or less everyone accepted this, including conservatives. Most people thought that socialism and Marxism were the path towards the future. They haven't turned out to be so. That's one of the basic reasons for the crisis of political theory today, is the apparent collapse of socialism and Marxism. That collapse is all the more poignant because these were the traditions which really dominated something like a century, not just of political theory, remember, but of political practice. It's crucial when you start to think about Marx and Marxism, what they meant, what they are, that Marx never intended to produce just an intellectual theory. Marx always spoke of the union of theory and practice. Marx argued the philosophers have interpreted the world, the point is to change it. Marx wanted to introduce a body of theory which would actually create a new society. And in this, he was successful. That society itself was not successful. But Marx probably had more influence on 20th century history than any single individual or thinker, including the main classical religious thinkers, because I think you could say Marxism's had more impact on 20th century world history than any religious system has done. So you're talking about something very, very major in world history. Let me just tell you a little bit about Marx's life, because it's relevant to understanding his ideas and the evolution of Marxism, very, very briefly, because you can read this anywhere you want to. Marx was born, of course, in Germany. He was a student radical. This did not endear him to the authorities. Therefore, he was forced to leave Germany. What he wanted was an academic career. If Marx had achieved an academic career, the whole history of the 20th century would possibly have been different. Marxism would never have been born. He did not achieve this career. He was hounded out of Germany. And while he was still in his 20s, he left to go to Paris. His visit to Paris, his stay in Paris, made a major impact on him. But he couldn't stay there either. The authorities in Paris weren't too keen on him either. So he came to the UK, to England specifically, and he spent most of his career working in the old British Museum reading room, only about a mile away from here. In the old days, before they changed the British Library, there was always a scrabble to try and sit in Marx's desk. You know, if you got in there first in the morning, you might get in Marx's desk, but there always seemed to be some guy with a grey beard sitting there from very early in the morning. No one knew whether he was real or not. Marx never, therefore, achieved an orthodox career. And there is a relationship between his biography and his writing, I think. He didn't achieve an orthodox academic career. He always lived in poverty. He was supported by his friend Engels a lot of his life. He sort of went with his Sainsbury's bag. Well, they didn't have the number equivalent of Sainsbury's bag up and down the British Museum, where he penned his great works. And he died unknown. Marx, in his own lifetime, was not well known. Marxism did not exist in Marx's lifetime. The St. Paul to Marx, the person who made Marx into Marxism, was precisely Marx's lifelong friend and colleague, Friedrich Engels. Engels it was who popularized Marxism. Engels it was who translated what was the laborings of an obscure, poverty-stricken, frustrated academic. There are frustrated academics, not many, but there are a few. It's only the frustrated ones who change the world, you know, they'll just hang around and give lectures. And Engels was interesting. Engels was a rich businessman. Marxism was founded by a rich entrepreneur. He was a playboy. You know, Marx famously fathered an illegitimate child, which was only discovered, I think, after his death. But Engels was a true playboy. He had many mistresses. He lived in an opulent sort of way. And he was a successful Manchester businessman. He was German, but he was a successful businessman in Manchester. So Marxism was born of business, really. It was born of a successful entrepreneurial activity. Not unimportant, because Marx admired entrepreneurs. Many subsequent Marxists have not done so, but Marx did, and he had a model close at hand with Engels. Now, the reason why Marx's sojourns in these countries are so important is that it's out of this peripatetic career that Marx built his system. It was combined famously of three elements. In Germany, he was influenced by classical German philosophy. And particularly by the writings of the conservative philosopher Hegel. What Marx tried to do was to radicalize Hegel. To stand him on his head, or as Marx said, to turn him from standing on his head and put him back on his feet. That's how Marx saw his early career. You don't need to know much about Hegel, but one or two interesting things. Crucial thing, Hegel saw history as the clash and struggle of opposites. Hegel thought history was not born from a kind of simple accretion of knowledge or accumulation of of knowledge. History was born through struggle. In Hegel's case, it was a struggle of ideas. Marx thought of it as a struggle of classes, but the idea of the struggle of opposites, that out of the clash of opposites something different is born, that is a crucial idea in Hegel, and Marx simply domesticated it into his own ideas. Technically, that's known as the dialectic, or dialectics, sometimes called. The idea of the dialectic is just the idea that out of the struggle of opposites, something new is created. It comes originally from conversation in Greek. Dialectics meant argument. You get one argument, you get a counter-argument. Out of it, you get some kind of synthesis, which is different from each of the original arguments. Same thing happens in history. So Hegel thought, and so Marx agreed. Except Marx thought of himself as a materialist, not an idealist philosopher, as Hegel was. Secondly, when he was in Paris, he came into contact with French socialism, French communism. The ideas of communism and socialism were born in France, not accidentally. They were really born of the French Revolution. Many people, as people always think after revolutions, believe the French Revolution did not go far enough. Conservatism was born out of the belief the French Revolution was too destructive, while socialism and communism were born out of the belief that it was only a partial revolution, didn't go far enough in transforming our lives. So socialist and communist ideas were well discussed before Marx got to France. Marx did not invent either of these terms. In fact, many of the notions associated with Marx were not invented by him, including the two I've mentioned, socialism and communism plus dialectics. A number of people made an influence on him, but particularly the somewhat anarchistic French thinker Proudhon, who Marx later came to criticize. Out of this encounter with French thought, beside dialectic, you have to put socialism and communism, but I won't bother to put them here again on the right-hand side. Third, his stay in the UK, fundamental for Marx's thought. It's in the UK that Marx thought that he'd reached his mature philosophy, his mature outlook. And this was based upon political economy. Political economy was simply the old name for economics, what later came to be called economics. Classical political economy. Main figures here, Adam Smith, Ricardo, and others. From these authors sort of sealed Marx's ideas, because Marx, ever after he got to Britain, and he was by then still only in his late 20s, Marx thought what his project was is a critique of political economy. The whole motive force of socialism, as Marx formulated, was the critique of political economy. So the subtitle of Marx's masterwork, Capital, was a critique of political economy. That's what he thought he was doing for most of his career, showing that the economic theory of a market society can be turned back against itself to introduce a society which would be based upon different principles. So Marx took from these authors some more than one of his main notions, but I mentioned two: the significance of capital. And we'd be looking at what capital actually is. I mean, it's a term in our language now, but it was a very new term in those days, the idea of capital. Capital means money, but it means many other forms of investment. And especially the idea of the commodity, plus the idea of capitalism itself. A commodity means anything you can buy and sell, anything you can buy and sell on a market. Marx thought that the two great revolutions, especially the Industrial Revolution, signaled the advent of a commodity-based society, the first one in history. previously, all previous types of society, like I mentioned last time, been rural agrarian society. You didn't need to sell your labour power yourself as a commodity to an employer. You didn't really purchase very much. You made most of what you used. In a market society, this is totally changed. Market societies are based upon buying and selling commodities, and we ourselves become commodities in a market. Everyone here probably will have to sell their labour power to an employer to get a job. That's what it's like in a market society, but it was not true in any previous kind of society, which was basically agrarian. Living in a society where everything is a commodity, everything is bought and sold, Marx thought was not a great thing. It certainly generated prosperity, but we could still ask the same question today. Do we want to live in a society where everything can be bought and sold, where the market is the main indicator, the main criterion of whether something exists? Well, Marx thought not. He wanted to change that, and we should still listen to this critique today. The idea of capitalism at that time was also quite new. It was a long time. I mean, this is true of lots of terms that we're familiar with. It's a long time before such a term became widely used. Capitalism was not widely used, certainly in the popular press, until the 20th century. Many conservative thinkers and liberal thinkers didn't like the term capitalism, and they never used it. They associated it actually with socialism. They thought when anyone described an economy as capitalist, they were actually wanting to overthrow it. So it took a long time for the term capitalism to become a familiar term, but it was Marx primarily who was instrumental, first of all, in starting to popularize it. Now, Marx was a guy, as I mentioned last time, who could never finish anything, again, a true academic, and therefore his whole life is a kind of struggle to produce this critique of political economy. There are just two or three things which, if you want to know about the history of Marx and Marxism, you must know about. The first is a thing called Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, which has a fascinating history of 1844. Sometimes also called the Paris Manuscripts. And there are also other names for it, for reasons I'll mention later. That's the first main thing everyone should read if you're interested in the evolution of socialism and Marxism. You have to look at that. It's very short. It's a true gem. It's one of the great works, really, in the history of political thought. Second, this thing I'm sure you will have heard of, Communist Manifesto of 1848. 1848, remember, was the year of revolutions in Europe. And thirdly, Capital, which was published in three volumes. Economic Philosophical Manuscripts had this really interesting history. The Economic Philosophical Manuscripts were simply observations that Marx made reading around when he was essentially still a student on Hegel, Proudhon, and other authors. He never intended them for publication. They were simply jottings. He therefore left them. They were never published in his lifetime. Engels also refused to publish them. Engels said, these are juvenile writings. We're not especially interested in them. He never published them. They weren't published until 1929. They didn't become, 1929, 1932, they didn't become well known until actually after the Second World War, when they were widely translated and disseminated in Western Europe. As soon as they became well known, they kind of introduced themselves in actual political practice, because many of the early rebellions against East European communist regimes were inspired by the Paris Manuscripts. The rediscovery of these manuscripts 100 years after they were written had a dramatic impact upon the history of Western East European politics. Western Marxists turned to them, East European Marxists used them against orthodox communism. The economic philosophical manuscripts, therefore, don't really have a name. These were names that were just invented for them subsequently. And these came to be called the writings of the young Marx. These were the core thing for the young Marx. The young Marx became kind of libertarian Marx of the 1950s, 1960s. Many of the 1960s student rebellions inspired by the young Marx, not by Marx's mature writings. The young Marx was also claimed by religion. There was a strong alliance between Catholicism and Marxism. It's still going on to some degree in some sectors in South America. For reasons I'll mention in a minute, many religious thinkers were attracted to the writings of the young Marx. They also saw them as a way of criticizing mature Marxism. This is partly because in the economic philosophical manuscripts, Marx has these wonderful reflections on the nature of religion. It's in these manuscripts that Marx introduced the idea of alienation. The notion of alienation, which came from Hegel, was given a central role by Marx in the economic and philosophical manuscripts. Marx argues that in these manuscripts, he argues, we are living in a society which is created by humans, but which is not humane. History is made by human beings, but they don't realize it. History is made by human beings, but human beings live under the aegis of tradition, superstition, the gods. The point of our lives, therefore, should be to reclaim history for human values and for human purposes. This, at the time also, in the 50s and 60s, came to be called Marxist humanism, and orthodox Marxists didn't like it one little bit. But Marxist humanism was the inspiration of many West European Marxists, as well as I mentioned, East European ones too. It's often thought that Marx is hostile to religion, and certainly subsequent Marxists were, most of them. But I believe Marx had a more interesting and slightly perhaps contradictory attitude towards religion, but a much more interesting one, which you can trace out in the Paris manuscripts. Marx says religion is the opium of the people. One of the most famous phrases, you know, in history, religion is the opium of the people, implying that religion drugs you, and because it drugs you with the ideal of heaven, you forget that you live in misery on the earth. And that surely does convey a hostile view of religion. But you have to read on, because immediately after Marx says that religion is the opium of the people, he has this fantastic set of phrases saying, religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. Religion is the heart of a heartless world. The heart of a heartless world. And for many people, the early Marx, how you should see it, is an attempt to claim that the values inherent in religion can be humanized. We shouldn't necessarily defer to an ethereal sphere of heaven what we can realize on this earth. If you proclaim brotherhood, if you proclaim love other people, if you proclaim community, why not try to realize them here and now? Rather than projecting them on an alien being, God, who somehow seems to issue us with commandments, Marx thought that we are the inventors of these values. Human history has created these values. We should redeem these values for ourselves. And I think if you listen to socialism as an attempt to hear the sigh of the oppressed creature, that is, if socialism is about redemption, if it's about trying to cope with poverty and exclusion, with misery that people suffer, then the ideals of socialism are contained in this document. It's arguable how far Marx himself sustained these ideals. And ever since then, there's been a long-standing debate about the relationship between the young Marx and the old Marx. But when you look around a commodity society today, when you see capitalism in this threshing sort of world crisis, I think the idea of where you find the heart of a heartless world is just as relevant now as it was 150 years ago. And anyone who turns to these sources would still get some value from them. Communist Manifesto is a much more straightforward political tract in which Marx says that capitalism will be transformed and a socialist society will be born. I'll say more about that immediately in the next lecture. Capital itself was Marx's masterwork, not very easy to read. Only one volume was published in Marx's lifetime, Capital Vol. 1. The other two volumes were published by Engels after Marx died. And we don't know whether Marx would have published them at all or whether he would have published them in that form. They're kind of, Engels put them together from a whole load of manuscripts that Marx left around. Now, when you look at Marx and Marx's ideas, as I stressed earlier, you're looking at a person who changed history, who sought to change history and did so. And there are two kinds of reasons you could give as to why Marx was so successful in this and Marx's sort of views were so successful. One is the kind of young Marx type one, that is, Marxism, some people think, is the inheritor of Christianity. Marxism, some people think anyway, provided a secular version of some basic Christian ideals. And Marxism itself became a kind of surrogate religion. Many people, some interpreters, including some very scholarly ones, explain the impact of Marxism on history by saying Marxism was like a religion. It provided the same kind of hope, the same kind of idea of a world transformed, the same kind of idea of a sort of utopian future. Well, there are elements of that, but I don't think myself that is where the impact of Marx's ideas come from. They come much more from the intellectual power of the system of ideas that he presented. And I'd like to sketch out some of these ideas quickly so you get some feeling of what this intellectual power was, because what Marx did was to look again at the nature of history. He tried to insert an understanding of modernity or capitalism within history. He tried to show how if you get a grasp of history, you can see where history is leading us. I think it's really important to remember this relationship between Marx and Hegel. Hegel famously said, you might have heard this phrase which comes from classical mythology, the owl of Minerva only flies at dusk. If you want a good chat up party line, there you are. By that cryptical phrase, Hegel meant you can't predict history. Hegel thought you can only understand history looking back. According to Hegel, we only understand where we've got to in history once we've lived through it. For Hegel, it's rather like reading a detective story. If you want a loose analogy, you only understand the meaning of the story when you get to the end of the story, and then you kind of look back and reinterpret it. Well, Marx rejected that. That's the key difference, one of the key differences between Marx and Hegel. Marx said we can predict the future, we must strive to control the future, we should try to understand history in order to master history. Key theorem of what Marx came to call his materialist conception of history. Materialist conception of history sought to understand the real forces moving history and sought to show why capitalism must in turn be superseded. History is the history of different types of society. There is no type of society which is permanent. Capitalism will disappear as other types of society in history did. So to understand the intellectual power of Marx's ideas, I think you have to understand the basic tenets of Marx's conception of history. Let me sketch them in very quickly. They're very logical and they're very persuasive and they've influenced generations of people. First, Marx argues human beings must produce to survive. Humans must produce to survive. In other words, every society depends upon a material infrastructure, its economy, which is the condition of that society existing. You couldn't survive unless there was a production system. Now, this is a fundamental tenet of Marx's ideas, and a very interesting one. Human beings are not like the animals in their relationship to production and nature. Animals also produce, for example, bees or ants, in a certain sense, interact with nature. Human beings, Marx argued, interact with nature creatively. The difference between us and the animals is that we do not have instincts. If you look at the history of birds building nests, for example, well, of course, they produce to survive, but they do so instinctively. There is no history of nest building except through the physical evolution of the species. Human beings are born free, Marx argues. It's central to Marxian thinking. Human beings are born free because we do not have fixed instincts of that sort. Therefore, what we must produce, like the animals, to survive, but we must do so creatively. We're forced to creatively adapt to and master our environment. That is the origin of human history, Marx says. Animals do not have a history. Animals have an evolution. Human beings, of course, are part of an evolutionary scheme, but we have a history. We come from somewhere and we're going somewhere. This is because our attempt to master nature is included in our very relationship to nature. We have to master nature in order to survive. And that, for Marx, is what's made us the dominant species. Second, production is always social for human beings. Animals can survive as individuals. For example, some small animals lower down the evolutionary scale can survive immediately on their own. Well, human beings can't. Human beings depend upon families. Families depend upon communities. Communities depend upon a larger society. To be human is to be social. To be human is to be part of a wider society. Therefore, all our interactions with nature are not done as individuals, they're done socially, they're done communally. Production systems are always social, Marx argued. And he had a sort of technical term for this. He called this the social relations of production. The social relations of production of feudal society are that people produce from land. They mainly work on farms. There's a kind of system of feudal obligation, all the rest of it. The relations of production of capitalism and industrial society are quite different. It's a collective system based upon factory production, based on exchange of goods and commodities and so on. Third, the relations of production determine a great deal about the rest of a society. They are an infrastructure, as I put earlier, on which a superstructure of ideology and political institutions is built. Marx says you can see this in the way we call a society a society. A feudal society is feudal because it's based upon a certain set of relations of production. An industrial society is industrial because you're talking about its production system. But in each case, you get a particular set of ideas, you get a set of political institutions, you get a set of religious institutions. In feudalism you had Catholicism. In capitalism you have Protestantism. Marx thought this was not accidental. There is a superstructure of ideology, of politics and culture, which is built around, although not completely determined by, the economic substructure or relations of production. Fourthly, I don't have time to explain in detail why this is so, but a key aspect of the relations of production is who owns and who does not own the means of production. I'll explain what that means in a sec. Who owns and who does not own the means of the production? Means of production are simply what you use to produce in our relationship to nature. So in feudalism, it's agriculture. In capitalism, it's industry. Marx argues that if you look at the structure of human societies, a key sort of dynamic influence on them is who owns versus who is excluded from owning these instruments of production. And he thought this was a sort of central structuring feature of different societies. He also thought there are some societies where nobody owns the means of production. This is true of small, primitive agricultural communities. These he called primitive communism. In primitive communist societies, the means of production are owned collectively. But once you get the development of Rome, of China, the big civilizations, and then of modern industrial civilization, you get a division. The reason this is so important is that property, who owns and who does not own the means of production, gives us the clue to the class system. In all types of society beyond primitive communism, ownership of property structures many other things. It's an economic basis of class division. So if you look at feudalism, you're looking at the history of the aristocracy and gentry as compared to the mass of the producing peasantry. If you look at capitalism, you're looking at those who own capital, the factories, the machines, the rich, versus those who don't, those who have to sell their labor power to them for a living. Most societies in history have been class societies, Marx thought. The ones of the future will not be, for reasons which I'll probably get on to only discussing next time. Six, this in turn gives us the clue to ideology and power. Because if you recognize that in, say, a feudal society, you have a class system where the interests of the aristocracy are simply different from those of the serfs and the peasantry over whom they dominate, you have to ask, why do the serfs put up with it? If you have such class division, if it's so important in so many different societies, why do the majority of people who don't have much control over their lives put up with it? Well, the reason, Marx says, is ideology. Ideology is not necessarily consciously produced. It simply is an idea system which legitimates class domination. And in any type of class society, you tend to have a dominant form of legitimate ideology. So in feudalism, you had a system which depended upon belief in blood right, the right of the aristocracy to rule. Only a small minority of people can rule. You had ideas of feudal serfdom, and you had ideas coming from religion in the shape of the Catholic, early Catholic Church. They were the kind of ideological glue that held the society together. When it's transformed, you get the French Revolution transforming feudalism into a market capitalist society. Well, then the ideas become transformed. The ideas we treat as our ideas, democracy, individualism, the rise of Protestantism as well, these kinds of ideas, Marx thought, are expressions of a market society. They're a very different type of ideology. They are still an ideology, but very different from feudal ideology. So for Marx, the changes in ideological systems tend to follow on from changes in the economic order. This is a very powerful notion which has influenced many historians, many of whom would not necessarily call themselves Marxists. How do you introduce a dynamic into this system? Well, Marx thought you can do so from this scheme. He thought if you analyze a society like feudalism, if you look back to the early days of feudalism, you have a certain set of relations of production which characterize a feudal society. I'm sorry, I can't answer questions because it's too late on. I've got to finish in a couple of... Oh, sorry. I'm going off the page, sorry. Can't answer questions. Can I put it here, then? No, I'll have to... Sorry about that. I'm not the master of this technology, really. For some reason, you have to start halfway down the page and finish halfway down the page. You have a certain set of relations of production. I'm just taking feudalism as an example of a type of society. In the early years of feudalism, feudalism is a decentralized agrarian system based upon serfdom and feudal fealty. However, Marx argues, for reasons I'll go into next time, you have a new set of relations of production developing within that society because of changes going on in it. Basically, what happened in feudalism was you got the emergence of an urban manufacturing sector which developed within feudal society. Feudalism generated trade, trade generated towns, towns generated commerce. As this happened, you got a new type of order coming into being within feudalism, setting up a kind of tension or contradiction within it. Eventually, Marx argues, this leads to revolution and the introduction of a new type of society. The towns were therefore the core of manufacture. People who lived in the towns were called citizens, or they were called, no laughing, burghers, or they were called bourgeois. These all have the same roots. They all mean city dweller. These were also people who lived off trade, commerce, and capitalism. So what you have is a capitalist society emerging within, generated from feudalism, which eventually transforms feudalism. The 1789 revolution is the outcome of this process. When you get economic change like that, it's followed then by political and cultural change. So the French Revolution as a political revolution was born of economic transformation of feudalism. The political revolution then made possible an ideological revolution, which created what we know today an industrial capitalist society. Look forward to seeing you next week. We'll carry on the story. Thanks very much.